C1A. Number 13B.
And the beautiful thing is, you know, that when it becomes a birth, one never says, I know that. Even if one has heard it 100 times, it's always new. That's the funny thing of it. It's something incredible. I don't know what it is. But the point is that once the 7 days of creation begin to be born in oneself, one just can't stop thinking about them and loving them. And every time finding they are strange beyond words, because they are life. And life feeds our famished affection. And life always feeds again our affection for that word order. And so the word always feeds the word. And so the word always teaches the word. It never goes to anything else but by itself, to itself. God never goes outside itself. It always revolves within itself. And the point is that we see that we give birth to this order, and that we don't take it as a new theory or as a new concept. It must be born into us. Then it is a birth. And then only a new birth can bring a new man and make out of us a new man. So in this subject of soul, where she shows that because God is soul, and that soul impels, because soul is definite, impels a perseverance and steadfastness, that it brings spiritual attainment. That only through that sense of worshipping the spiritual, something in us becomes steadfast, and that steadfastness brings spiritual attainment. Perhaps you have seen how in this subject she shows how that perseverance and steadfastness of soul was presented. That it is a sense, as I said, of not giving in, of not wavering, of not being unsteady and undetermined, that the spiritual in us just brings to birth a sense of firmness, steadiness, and consistency and constancy, and so that we find we are standing on secure and good ground. How does she evolve that subject? How does she say that we can go that straight line from sense to soul? How does she say how we get that balanced and definite sense of soul? She says, well, first in soul as mind, she says, well, by having the wisdom. We must have the wisdom to follow this straight line of mind. She says, well, we must have the wisdom to accept that in our endeavor, in our intentions, we stick to the divine mind, to the leading of the divine mind, and not to something else. And so, in following this leading, she says, as soul and spirit, therefore, what it demands is to resist any drawback, is to resist any drawback by making vigorous effort in the right direction. She always comes at vigorous effort. We will have that as long as we are in the word chapters. Afterwards, we don't have that anymore. Most of these things, of these problems, they are only in the first 3 chapters, and then they are done. Then quite a different atmosphere and quite a different standpoint takes place. But it shows how, at the beginning, you see, the demand is to make the best out of our best qualities. Before she speaks of metaphysics, up to now she hasn't spoken of metaphysics. She hasn't used the term metaphysics. Of metaphysics, which means the system of ideas. Before she can reach that, we will see how through the first 3 chapters she uses the best we have, the best divine use in man, to strengthen that and strengthen that until it is so clean and so strong and so devoid of negative points that she then can usher into the realm of metaphysics. So here she gives a sense, well, in that persistency, we have to make vigorous effort. It's not that sense where usually the human mind says, well, God should do it, and I just have to wait quietly in the corner with my hand in my lap and wait what happens. at the beginning it is demanding that the divine overcomes the human at every point. It's demanding that we do something, that we act boldly, that we turn away from material sense, that we stick to that order and don't give in, and make vigorous effort in doing so. Then she goes on and says that in this vigorous effort to stick to the good, we should never give in. Occupy it till I come. Don't go back. Don't become a sluggard. Stick to it. Go forward. Just as John Dolly always used to say, let's go forward. Let's go on and on and on. He expressed that quality very much, never to give in. And it's the divine quality, because it's a hue of soul which says there is only one track, and that's from sense to soul, never another track. And because soul knows only that track, it demands of us to resist the other way, to give in. It says, and in this effort and in this persistency, let's be persistent ourselves, as in the tone of principle, and not by vicarious work. Don't let us be sidetracked in believing that the other fellow will do it for us. The other fellow may be a help to us, may support us in difficulties, but the way we have to go is an individual way, and each one has to go it. And therefore, from the point of view of the way of life, there is no vicarious work. There's no vicarious work. Everyone has to go it. And so we jolly well have to make up our minds that each one of us has to go that way. And so in life, she says, in this persistency, you have to be persistent in your sacrifice. She speaks there must be a constant sacrifice, and that a single sacrifice and a single effort is not sufficient. It gives that sense of life, which is all the life is that sense of repeating and repeating and renewing and renewing. And it's also in the sense that this renewing must be on the repeating in the sacrifice. The human mind in us says, well, I have made a big sacrifice. That should be enough. That should do it now forever. But life says no. Life says, I demand of you constant sacrifice. Constant. Until then, we are ushered into the realm of metaphysics. There is no more sacrifice. But until the human has yielded to the divine, and the atonement and Eucharist is that big chapter where it shows that the human must yield to the divine. Until it has yielded to the divine, life demands constant sacrifice. And it is that which says, don't murmur if life demands that of us. If it has demanded yesterday a sacrifice and today it demands a sacrifice again, don't murmur. Something in us wants to say, well, isn't it enough now? Now I should get my peace. No, it's a constant sacrifice which is demanded. And only in that way, she says, and in truth, in that way we get the firmness and the steadiness and the establishment of a firm foundation of a spiritual understanding as the evidence gained from spirit, which stands and which can no more be shaken, which can no more be taken out of its balance, but which has the balance of life, of soul. And so she goes to the rest and says, and thus working out our own salvation by constantly trusting all to God, we are freed from the hopelessness of achieving something. But finally we see that sense of sticking to the right road, of clinging to the golden rule, of the rule of soul, that not giving in to any other temptation, that leads us actually to a solution. So we get there a very nice but strong and firm sense that soul demands that we really represent soul, and that we are never a bad representative by giving in, but stick to the rule, to go from sense to soul. That's the atonement. Atonement always atones with God, and therefore our soul, it says, is always away from sense to soul. Atonement is not that God reconciles himself to man, therefore it's never soul going to sense. It's always from sense to soul. Let's see how this tone, I just want to speak about tone, is also represented in the third day compared with the third statement of the commandment. See, in the third day we have, let the waters be gathered together. and to one place so that the dry land appears. We get the links of the second day to the third day. The waters are now gathered together in such a way that the identity appears. That's always true. The more I worship in thought and in life and in inward attitude, the more I use the water, the more I concentrate and focus the water, the holy thought, the more I do that, something definite grows in me. The dry land appears. A new concept, the divine concept, the divine identity of anything grows up in me, and it makes click. And so the divine identity appears. In the commandment it says, thou shalt not make unto thee any graven image. See, thou shalt not make unto thee any graven image. In other words, we shall not give birth to our concept of a thing. We shall not make up what our own identity. We are so apt to outline something. That's a false identity. We think it should work out this way, or it should turn out this way. We make an a graven image. The concept of our own, we try to establish the concept of our own. And we say, perhaps inwardly, well, that's the divine concept. That's the best I can think. It should turn out that way. See, but it's still our own. And that's the danger. And then if something doesn't work out that way, we feel we have failed. But the divine way is shown through the days of creation, the commandments. The days of creation says, don't make your own concept, says, but gather the waters. Let the waters be gathered together. Let me worship the spiritual and love it and adore it and value it and have my whole gratitude and affection for it, see the bigness of it, the value of it, substance of it, the comfort of it, see God in His mighty, the adorable one, see that, and then something in us begins to speak. The identity of a thing begins to appear. Maybe the identity of how something will work out. Maybe the identity of what step I have to take next. Maybe the identity of reasons and might be the identity of that. Whatever the solution may be. And that is an attitude which demands of me the commandment, the third statement of the commandment, which says, and in doing that, and in letting that come to birth, I'm not going to establish my own concept. Thou shalt not make unto thee any graven image. I'm not going to outline how it should be and what should happen and when it should happen and this and that. I have that word as the Christ attitude which frees itself, which lays down one's own concept of identifying a solution. Well, the chapter on in prayer, the third subject in prayer said the same thing. It said, it gave that definite rule of reformation, ask us not to speculate on God. Said, I give you the rule of reformation, and without reformation there is no progress and there is no solution. And Atonement and Eucharist comes in and says, yes, I showed you the rule in prayer, but now stick to it, stick to the rule. Stick to the rule of going from sense to soul. Don't give in. Stick to it. You see, the command comes in and says, stick to it. Stick to that until you have that inward steadfastness where you will win through. You will win through. And so don't bow down before them. Don't bow down before your own concept, how it should work out. See, right at the beginning of the third subject says, don't go once a bit westward and then a bit eastward, thinking that you are drifting in the right direction. Stick it through in the right direction. It is a very crucial point, that soul, because as you know, soul is always somehow a turning point, because from the three to the four, that three and a half, which always appears, is that turning point where we begin to lay down the mortal concept, the personal concept. And through the first three, you have seen how that is. See, through the first three, you have seen how it works. We all know that we have to lay down the mortal concept. We all know that we don't have to be personal. But how to be impersonal? That's the question. We can't just by learning to be impersonal to be impersonal. We can't. We just can't. I don't believe it. We can confess to it. We can profess to it. We can say it. And we can mean it. And we can believe in it, but we can't be. To be it is to go through the birth, through the new birth. And the new birth is the living through the orb. Now we can see so easily how we become impersonal. Namely, I start with mind the first day and say, not my mind shall be done. I'm seeking another mind, through the mind of God. And atonement says to me in addition, and hold fast to that mind and give up steadily, constantly, constant sacrifice, give up your own mind, your own wish, and so on, your own concept, give it up. And in the measure I'm honest in that, I begin to see in the second the beauty of it, the loveliness of it, and I begin to be grateful for it, to be grateful for this solution, for this way out. And becoming grateful for it, I begin to imbibe this new attitude of mine, the first day. I begin to imbibe it and love it and take it in my heart and in my bosom, and it comes into my womb and begins to unfold and to develop and to develop and begins to stir and becomes greater and bigger and stronger and stronger, and the waters gather together until it says as the third, I oust out everything that doesn't belong to the pure and the divine. And I come to the third, the dry land appears. Something new always begins to appear in a new sense, new identity, a new sense of being, a new selfhood begins to appear. But it's the outgrowth of a spiritual development. And it isn't something which I have learned I must do, which I have been said I should do. But it's something which inwardly grows and strengthens, which Mrs. Eddy says in that second stage. It isn't a thing that happens from one day to the other, which comes with days and needs patience and that it takes time. The time element comes in, and we must consider that. But when the new birth takes place and something new in us speaks to us, the representative of soul begins to speak in us, it gives a sense of satisfaction, happiness. One feels to be enormously rich. I think one gets the feeling of resurrection in a sense where you feel, I have left the world already a little bit behind. It gives a sense of the bigness of manhood, the bigness of our own manhood, because it's no more the mortal sense of us, the personal sense of us, the egoistic sense of us which speaks. And so it is ready to accept the leadings and the government and the commands of principle, because one has reached that point where one does no more interfere with one's personal sense. And if principle begins to talk to us and says, now you are willing to obey principle, and then it says, now I have a wonderful thing in store of you. Now I can express myself. Now I can express myself as the fullness of that principle. Always giving that principle out in fullness, and I get a new sense of life, really a sense of life, really a sense of life which is vast, which is big, which is positive, which is divine and not human and not mortal. It says, oh, I can draw from that principle. Every day I can draw from that principle, because that order of the world, as the world, is an eternal order. And I always can nourish myself from that order, and it always brings me into a new life, until I have what? I have a universe of truth. I have a universe of true ideas, and those true ideas begin to work for me. That's true. That's the point where the wonder of glory comes in, that suddenly one begins to realize that if one is father to a universe, that if one draws from that one principle constantly and projects it and gives it out mentally, lovingly, with one's heart, with one's feeling, with one's everything, gives it out and out and out, that one builds up, that one calls into existence a new universe of life, of fullness. And that universe sounds back. Love is reflected in love. It resounds back and it begins to save us. That true universe begins to save us, to protect us, to help us, to sustain us, to do anything it can do to establish our true manhood. That's that point where you sometimes say that everything has worked together for me for the solution. Everything in the universe was active and was working in order to establish true things. And so this principle says, you see that I have a wonderful plan, that if you trust my principle, you will always be safe. You always have a sense of love, that it leads you into salvation, that it leads you to fulfillment. But the crucial point, you see, the crucial point is here between the chapter on prayer and the chapter on Atonement Eucharist, because it's going over the 3.5. We are usually very willing to accept prayer. The whole movement, I think, has accepted prayer and has never gone further than the standpoint of prayer. It has never been willing to lay down the mortal sin. It's in us something which says, yes, I want to know God, and I want to pray to God, and I want to give my problems into the hands of God and put it into the hands of God. But then comes the Atonement Eucharist and says, and are you willing to give up, to lay down the false sense of life? Are you willing to be Christ and ask Christ to stay in Christ? And if you stay in Christ, then you can no more fulfill the lusts of the flesh. Then you can no more be tempted by the world. Then you are willing to preach the gospel. You are willing to act according to this principle. And therefore you will be pushed into heaven. But the crucial point is there. And it is that, I must stop here. And so we must see very clearly, you see, that we don't stop in our attitude at prayer, but that we take the implications of prayer, which says, if you want me, God, you have to lay down other God. If you want to be one with the divine mind, you have to sacrifice the human mind, the egoistic mind, one's own mind. If you want to be atoned at one with spirit, you have to give up matter, material sense, material purposes as the center of your affection. If you want to be one with soul, then you have to give up your own egoistic sense of things, your instability of pursuing the right course, and you have to stick to the right course and go through it through hell and high water, just to stick it through. Well, here we stop, and I have talked 10 minutes too much. Is it too early if we start at 5:30, or shall we start 5:40? All right. Thank you.